That, unfortunately, is where Pinky Niedermeyer comes in. I hadn't counted on Helen Fargus spilling her guts. Greetings, folks. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler. Happy to be bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for tuning in. From the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, I take our first story by Robert Greer. It's titled, A Casual Look. This time, I wasn't running from the cops or ex-wives looking for past due alimony. I had two of them. Or the score of suckers I'd duped in various bunco schemes over the years, or even the IRS, who claimed that I owed the government tens of thousands of dollars. No, this time I wasn't anywhere near that lucky. This time I was running for another reason, running to keep Pinky Niedermeyer from sending me to the other side of life. I'd never met Niedermeyer, the Rocky Mountain region's most notorious hitman. I didn't know what he looked like, where he operated out of other than somewhere within the stone's throw of Denver, or much else about him. I had learned from an acquaintance that Niedermeyer had lost all of his front teeth, top and bottom, and the pinky finger of his left hand during a New Year's Eve firefight outside the village of Songvay, 3 days before he was scheduled to come back from a year-long U.S. Marine Corps tour of duty during the war in Vietnam. He had received a Purple Heart for doing his duty that day, and Andrews Samuel Niedermeyer had also earned himself a nickname. I was told he preferred to be called a settlement agent rather than a hitman, but as has been said, a rose by any other name remains a rose. It was rumored that never in 20 years since his return from the war had he ever bungled the job. So in this run for my life, I had a right to be scared. I also expected, unfortunately, to soon be outside and shivering. I needed to gas up. So I nosed the silver BMW 750 that I had paid just over $100,000 for 8 weeks earlier down an I-70 off-ramp and into a service road that led to a truck stop just west of the Colorado mountain town of Rifle. It was a cloudless night. I pulled up to one of the truck stop's 16 pumps and grabbed my coat off the front passenger seat, mentally preparing myself to brave what the car's thermometer was telling me was 17-degree weather outside. I'd cracked my door and was about to step out of the car when a bug-eyed little man appeared and asked, "Hey, fill her up, mister?" "Oh, what?" "Gas your vehicle for you." I looked him up and down in the subdued pump island lights, worried that he might be Niedermeyer, who I sensed had been tailing me ever since I'd crossed into Colorado from Utah 2 hours earlier. As I continued to stare at him, trying the best I could to size him up, he eyed me quizzically. He was wearing grease-stained bib overalls. His head was almost peanut-shaped, and he sported a scraggly beard. A navy watch cap covered most of his oddly shaped head, the top of his ears, and a bit of both cheeks. The parts of his face that weren't protected by facial hair or the watch cap were cold weather pink. He looked even more puzzled when I said, "It's 17 degrees out here, bud. What's with the 1950s gas jockey routine? I'm perfectly capable of pumping my own gas."
Sorry, mister, I'm just trying to earn a poor man's dollar.
Have to somehow, since I'm not a rich kid ski bum, some snot-nosed college kid on my mid-March spring break, a fat cat cattle rancher, or the owner of this frickin' truck stop. I do what I can to make it do around here.
It's pretty good money in the winter when no one wants to get out of their car and gas up. If you've got no more questions, go ahead and pump your own gas. Californian that I was, and shivering, I said, No, hey, wait a minute. I do have a question. In fact, it's more of a request. How about smiling at me? You nuts or something? Heck no. There's $10 in it for you. You look surprised. Now, why would I do that? Smile, I mean. For $10, humor me. Looking surprised and a little scared, he obliged and flashed a full set of perfectly aligned pearly whites top and bottom before quickly clamping his mouth shut. With my right hand at my side, ready to draw my holstered 9mm, I stared intently at his left hand and asked, "You missing any fingers?" "Well, not that I know of. How about slipping off those gloves of yours and showing me your hands?" "You're absolutely crazy," he started to walk away. When I said, "You can earn yourself another 10 spot, he stopped. "You some kind of freak or something, mister?" "No." "Then what's your angle?" "I don't have one." "Make it 20, he said boldly. I nodded my okay. He slowly slipped off his gloves and held out both hands. I looked them both over. All his fingers were there. I cracked a half smile, watching him blow warm air into his now cupped hands and quickly slip his gloves back on. "Anything else? Now, mind you, I'm not about to take these overalls off for you." He slapped the bib, Tarzan-like, and frowned. "Nope. Fill her up. Premium." Sure thing. Now, how about my $30? He eased the gas nozzle from its housing and set it for an automatic fill. When I slipped the bottom edge of my coat back to get my wallet, exposing my 9mm, his eyes widened and he all but pivoted to run. "Here you go," I said, handing him a 10 and a 20. He grabbed the bills, looking scared to death as he did. "Food any good at this place?" I asked. "Yeah, it's decent." The gas nozzle clicked off. He didn't bother to top off the tank. "Do I pay you?" No, just go inside and tell him you gassed up on pump 7 and it took $23.17. Still looking rattled, he eased away from me and headed for the next island of pumps to where another car was pulling up. Thinking, trusting folks, these mountain people, I debated whether I should tell whoever I was supposed to pay inside that I had just filled up my vehicle or stiff the SOBs. Smiling and thinking, nah, not worth it, I cranked the car's engine and headed for the parking spot near the restaurant, but not before glancing out my window to see the gas jockey mouth to a new customer, "Fill her up." I was on the run for two reasons. Reason number one, Helen Fargus, a Las Vegas showgirl I just had to have, despite the fact that she was already taken. Well, maybe taken was not the right word. Married. Now, that was the more appropriate description. I didn't want her in the way you might be thinking, not in a sexual sense. Well, at least not at first. And even though she was statuesque, 6 feet tall and well endowed in every womanly aspect, the equivalent of a fine French wine, there to be adequately savored, I needed her for a second and far more important reason. I needed her because she was the key to my gaining access to a $250,000 16-by-25-inch painting by the great American illustrator N.C. Wheath. A painting owned by her blockheaded, glass-eyed, impotent husband Louis Devare, I wined, dined, and screwed the airhead showgirl behind Devare's back for almost 6 months in order to get her to toss in with me. It's only one painting, he has others. I had to keep reminding her until she finally caved. And believe it or not, in the end, in spite of all the fancy alarm systems protected his four-acre estate and home. I simply walked into his house one evening while he was gone and his Jezebel, Helen, deactivated the house alarm system and ushered me into his office. A couple of minutes later, I walked off with the painting. 2 weeks later, I dropped Miss Fargus off my ticket and ditched her butt. That was after I had arranged to sell the wreath to a Baltimore fence who had a buyer willing to cough up to $250,000. That, unfortunately, is where Pinky Niedermeyer comes in. I hadn't counted on Helen Fargus, her stage name, by the way, spilling her guts about the whole frickin' thing to her block-headed husband. But she did. What's even stranger and more problematic is that not only did he forgive her for her infidelity and her part in the burglary scheme, recognizing that she'd been duped by a pro, but he hired Pinky Niedermeyer to toast my butt. I parked as close as I could to the front door of the Truck Stops Combo Restaurant and Convenience Store. Luckily, the spot I scored was directly beneath a high-intensity overhead light. Once I was inside, I would grab a window table and keep a constant eye on my car. I padded my 9mm, slipped out the car to face the fresh blast of frigid high country air, and scanned the area a couple of times for good measure before heading for the front door. The warm air inside the old musty-smelling split log built felt good. The entryway's Spanish tile floor, scuffed turd brown from years of foot traffic and little if any maintenance, opened onto a massive high-ceilinged room filled with shelf after shelf after shelf of candy, toys, breakfast food of every imaginable kind, maps, over-the-counter drugs, Colorado souvenirs, and scores of auto parts. A lone couple, a man and a woman holding hands, walked the aisles, seemingly mesmerized by the huge display of goods. "He'll want a T-shirt with the Colorado Rockies image and the state seal on it," the woman said. "Well, I don't see anything like that," the man replied, flipping through a stack of T-shirts before glancing at me briefly. "Well, there has to be something," the woman joined in the rummaging. I smiled and thought, no Niedermeyer there, before I walked over to a bank of four cashier cages. Each cage had been framed in with split logs and boxcar siding. A 3-foot-high sheet of plexiglass served as a barrier between cashier and customer. The rest of each cage above where the cashier sat was open to the ceiling. Three cages were unoccupied. In the fourth cage, the one closest to the front door, sat a man with a frizzy red hair, a set of sloppy paintbrush eyebrows, and a nose that resembled a bird's beak, looking pretty much like a statue. When he looked up at me, I noticed that one of his eyes wouldn't stop traveling. "Ugh, cold outside," I hugged myself for emphasis. He didn't respond or smile or hiss or do anything but sit there and stare at me. I had 23.17 on pump 7. Guess my Beamer didn't require as big a drink as I figured. She's usually more thirsty. My attempt to get at least a grunt out of the man got nothing. When I asked, "How far is Denver?" and he said, "About 3 hours," I realized that most of his bottom front teeth were missing. He closed his mouth too quickly for me to get a look at his uppers. "Been working here long?" I asked, handing him 2 20s and hoping for another look. "Long enough." He slipped the bills beneath a vintage cash register till and counted out my change. He looked old enough to be Niedermeyer and was missing bottom teeth fit for the hitman. What would a man like Pinky Niedermeyer be doing manning a cashier's cage at some interstate truck stop in the middle of nowhere? On top of that, when he counted out my change, I didn't see any missing pinkies. In sum, it seemed as if the less-than-loquacious cashier just couldn't be Niedermeyer. I shrugged, pocketed my change, and headed toward a sign with an 8-inch long yellow index finger painted dead center. The finger with the word restaurant stenciled beneath it in big block letters pointed away from the cashier's cages. I stopped at the restaurant's entry to survey the dimly lit eatery, thinking that Naugahyde must have been in vogue or dirt cheap when the place was furnished. I counted seating for roughly 50 vertically striped red and tan Naugahyde-covered booths that flanked the walls. Six tables, sans Naugahyde, occupied the central part of the restaurant. There were 5 people inside the place when I walked in. A man nursing a coffee mug sat at one end of the tables. His left hand was wrapped around the mug, a forefinger hooked inside the handle. I strained to see if he might be missing a pinky. He wasn't. I felt a rush of relief as I walked briskly toward one of the window booths and took a seat. A man and a woman were seated in a booth catty-corner from me. They seemed to be arguing. I couldn't make out what they were saying, but their voices were raised, and after a minute or so of guttural back and forth, the man got up, slapped a single bill down on the table, eyed me intently as he walked past my booth, and left the restaurant. The woman remained seated with her head lowered, sobbing. I couldn't shake the feeling that for some reason, the two of them had been putting on a show for my benefit, especially since their act, if it truly was an act, hadn't started until the moment I'd walked in. I had the urge to go over and ask the woman what their argument had been about. What I did instead was memorized what she and the man who stormed out looked like. She was 35 or so, overly made up, lean, and from what I could see of her, quite tall. She was blonde, dyed I suspected, heavily costume bejeweled, and now that I had a chance to see her face clearly, quite pretty. The man had looked 50 or so, perhaps even a little older, although he'd walked past me quickly, only slowing his pace to take a good look at me. I cataloged his features. He was under 6 feet. His stride seemed athletic. There was a spot of gray at the one temple I'd been able to see. I hadn't noticed any facial wrinkles, and surprisingly, there in the very dead of winter, he was deeply tanned. I'd had no opportunity to assess whether he had any missing fingers or front teeth, but for certain he needed to stay on my radar, not because of the way he looked or because of any missing teeth or digits, but because of his lady companion, a tall, good-looking, showgirl trim figure of a woman with a possible Las Vegas connection. I needed to keep what the man looked like in my head for another important reason. On this rather showy exit, he'd taken his time to take a long, hard gander at me and do exactly what I was doing, staring intently at him. I had the feeling that he was memorizing my face as well. The remaining 2 people in the restaurant were clean-shaven men who both looked middle-aged, Niedermeyer's age. The man furthest from me was smoking a cigarette. On his plate were the remains of a burger flanked by a cluster of limp, soggy-looking fries. A half-full glass of what appeared to be water or perhaps club soda or ginger ale sat to the right of the plate. This smallish man had a mustache, mutton chop sideburns, and a military-style crew cut. His complexion was ruddy, his hairline receding. I couldn't get a good look at his teeth to see if he might be missing any because he was too far away. But there was one thing that was both unnerving and unmistakable about him. He was wearing gloves. Not workman gloves or cold weather gear, but thin white gloves. The kind of gloves a jeweler or appraiser might wear when handling expensive jewelry or examining a rare art object, like a painting. My blood ran cold. There was no reason for someone to be wearing gloves while inside a restaurant. No way in hell. Suddenly, I was worried, flustered, in fact. When a waitress finally arrived to hand me a menu, I rattled off, no need. I handed the menu back to her and said, I'll have a cheeseburger, medium rare, double order of fries, and a Coke. She shrugged, walked off, and returned about 10 minutes later with my order. The fries were perfect, but the burger was overdone, and the soda, obviously a fountain Coke prepared using syrup, was flat. I was, however, hungry enough to eat the mediocre fare while making sure to intermittently glance out at my Beamer to make certain that no problems arose there. While eating, I did my best to try to size up the remaining man in the restaurant. He was seated at a table a couple of arm lengths away from me. I couldn't see his hands or his teeth, but I didn't like his demeanor. He was sour to the waitress. He complained about the restaurant being too cold, which it was, and he grumbled about his coffee being bitter and his dessert, which looked like some kind of fruit pie, being soggy. "I would think you could do better," he complained. The obviously well-seasoned waitress remained calm. "Oh, I'll be happy to take the dessert off your bill, sir." He flashed her an insipid smile and said, "No, no need." As he rose to leave, I forced myself to eat it. I couldn't see if any of his fruit pie-stained front teeth were missing. It was clear to me at this point that the two major criteria I had been using to try to spot Niedermeyer were, when you came right down to it, rather imperfect. But they were the only concrete facts I had about him that I had to go on. Those and the fact that he was a Colorado native. So I'd move forward with what I had. And then it hit me. What if Niedermeyer wasn't looking to take me out up here in the Colorado Rockies? What if, instead, he was planning for a better, more appropriate time and place? What if he was planning his kill for Kansas or Indiana or Pennsylvania? After all, I still had a long way to go before I reached Baltimore and my $250,000 payday. Once again, I felt nervous. I tried to relax, telling myself that I could be overthinking things, dredging up possibilities that made no sense. What I needed to do was think more clearly. Would Niedermeyer really want to take me out up here in the Colorado Mountains, here on his home turf? Would he chance doing a hit that could possibly, because of its location, be traced to him? I was running every possible scenario through my mind when, peering out the window, I thought I saw something, or someone, near the front of my car. I craned my neck to get a better look, pressing my forehead against the restaurant's steamy window, but saw nothing. Nearly flattening my nose against the glass and assuring myself that there was nothing out there, I cursed myself for being so jumpy. To calm down, I reminded myself how easy it had been to lift the wreath. And as I sat there in the drafty restaurant with the slightly sweet smell of pork and beans hanging in the air, I briefly forgot about Pinky Niedermeyer and instead focused once again on how I had tricked the infatuated, easily duped Vegas showgirl into helping me steal an exquisite, very pricey painting. Calmer now, I almost blurted out, "It's good to be the king." The waitress startled me when she suddenly reappeared and asked, "Will there be anything else, sir?" Abruptly, I said, "No," before nodding toward the booth with the guy in the white gloves. "That man over there, do you know him and why he might be wearing those white gloves?" She stared at me quizzically, looking almost as if my question didn't deserve an answer before she said, "Nope and nope." She totaled my bill, handed me the check, and without another word, walked away. I looked at the little white-gloved man until I realized that I was staring. He turned his head away quickly. A moment later, he got up and headed toward the restroom at the back of the restaurant. It was my chance to break free. I slapped a 20 down on the table and made a beeline for the front door, telling myself that if the man wearing the white gloves was indeed Niedermeyer, he should have saved his bathroom break for later. I was out the door of the now empty restaurant within seconds. I stopped just before reaching the Beamer and scanned the perimeter for footprints or any signs of forced entry. There was nothing to suggest that anyone had been near the car. I opened the car door to get in and, gripping the butt of my 9mm, looked around the interior. Nothing. I slipped inside, cranked the engine, and glanced briefly toward the back seat and the drop cloth that covered all but one corner of the frame of my $250,000 Bounty. I smiled and took off. A mile down the frontage road and less than a quarter mile from the I-70 on-ramp, I heard a thumping sound coming from the rear of the car. I recognized the sound immediately. It was the uneven, asymmetrical sound of a tire that was going flat. I mumbled, "Ugh, crap," glanced nervously around the car's interior, pulled onto the shoulder, stopped, and stepped out of the vehicle into the frigid mountain air to see a nearly flat left rear tire. Realizing that the tire didn't have enough air to make it back to the truck stop, and that, like it or not, I was going to have to change it in what now felt like 10-degree weather, I slipped back into the car, grabbed a flashlight from the glove box, snapped it on, and began cursing my luck as I headed for the trunk. I popped the trunk and gasped. Inside, caught in the beam of light, lying there grinning while curled up like a rattlesnake on the trunk's floor, was my now practically toothless gas jockey. His left hand was wrapped around the grips of what looked like a .45 semi-auto. The barrel was aimed squarely at my face. I reached for my 9mm. A slightly muffled crack arose from the .45. A teardrop of muzzle flash appeared, the only visible prologue to the accelerated round that slammed into the bony arch above my right eyebrow. A shower of blood covered my eye as I dropped semi-conscious to one knee. I heard Pinky Niedermeyer say in a near whisper as I drifted toward the other side of life, "You should have taken more than a casual look at my replacement prosthesis when we were at the pumps, friend. Even better, you should have spent less time stealing fine art and more time learning about the wonders of modern dentistry and orthopedics." He reached into his coat pocket for his partial dentures and reinserted them, wiggling his prosthetic left pinky in my face. He smiled and walked off. All right, switching to something a little more in the time of the year that we are, I'm reading from the book called Why Did Santa Leave a Body? This story is written by Michael Allen Mallory, and it's called Breakfast with Tiffany. "Honey, do you love me?" "Oh, you bet," Jason answered through a spoonful of Cheerios, eyes on the sports page. Tiffany shifted, leaving her toast untouched. "If I tell you something, you promise not to get mad?" Jason flashed her an insincere smile. "Sure." I dented the minivan yesterday." The spoon hovered near his mouth. "Idiot," Can't drive worth a darn. Can't do anything worth a darn. Still, a promise was a promise. Forcing himself to be cordial, he asked, "Oh, what did you do? Back into a fire hydrant?" "No. I ran over the woman you're having sex with."
It was going to be a hell of a Christmas. A surreal morning had morphed into a frantic afternoon, one which found Jason Craig wandering through the Westgate Outlet Mall with a growing sense of desperation. Still reeling from breakfast, he tried to make sense of Tiffany's story. At first, he didn't believe her, given the muted nature of her emotions. Not until she showed him the dent, the damage to the front bumper of their Dodge Caravan had sent a spike through his heart. What would that kind of impact do to human flesh? To Melissa. He was desperate to know if it were all a spiteful joke, but Melissa hadn't answered her cell phone all day. Wasn't home, wasn't at work. He'd run out of options. They'd intentionally kept their affair low-key, avoiding popular places and being seen. There was no one else to call. Well, except the morgue. Then, like a whisper in the wind, a snatch of conversation had drifted back from memory. Something about taking time off from her job to help her aunt at a kiosk at the Westgate Mall. Oh, true or not, it had been enough to get him in his car on a snowy December afternoon and drive. Once inside the mall, he walked briskly across the mall's central courtyard, a man on a mission. Under the courtyard's vaulted glass roof, the outdoors had been brought inside in climate-controlled comfort. A holiday winterscape of live spruce trees and mounds of artificial snow, colored lights, and shiny ornaments. On the second-level balcony, large pine bough wreaths hung with red ribbons. Festive holiday tunes played through the PA system to entertain shoppers. None of that mattered. All he cared about was finding the kiosk. Jason's last hope was to find Melissa there. The escalator eased him down to the lower concourse as he gazed upon meandering throngs of shoppers in unzipped goose-down jackets or garish sweaters people only dared to wear at this time of year. Improbable designs of candy red, Kelly green, and snow white. Human obstructions, that's all they were. Sucking in a breath, he zigzagged his way around them like an ambulance driver fighting through stalled traffic. By a chocolatier's stand, he stopped in his tracks and wheeled around with the uncanny feeling he was being watched. Tinny seasonal tunes droned overhead as he searched nearby faces. Had Tiffany hired someone to keep tabs on him? Was that how she'd known about Melissa? Dismissing the thought, he put his legs in high gear. What did it matter now? Tiffany already knew about the affair. He came across a cluster of freestanding kiosks. One sold accessories for smartphones, while another vendor demonstrated his remote-controlled miniature toy helicopters. After the fifth kiosk, Jason began to wonder if he had come to the right mall. That's when he saw her, 80 feet away at Icelandic Sheep Woolens, a slender, dark-haired woman in a tight red sweater and form-hugging black slacks. Her ready smile and fresh good looks were as inviting as a clear mountain lake. Oh, Melissa held some packages while an older, plumper, more conservatively dressed version of her adjusted a price tag by a stack of woolen hats. "Jason, what are you doing here? You're..." He stopped. He couldn't blurt out she was supposed to be dead. Not in front of everyone. "Jason, you look like you've seen a ghost." "We need to talk." "I go on break in 15 minutes, Melissa told him, glancing at a Hispanic customer who examined a brown scarf. He gestured toward the benches near the display of brown wicker reindeers draped in white mini-lights. I'll be over there.
She nodded and turned to the customer, who looked at her with amazement. "Oh, it's so soft. I've never felt wool so silky." Jason Craig walked on rubbery legs. Alive. Melissa was alive. It was all a bad dream. He came to an abrupt stop. If it wasn't Melissa Tiffany had run over, who was it? Or did it even happen? Maybe it was all a con job, a way to get him to lead them to Melissa as proof of his infidelity, whoever they were. He wouldn't put it past Tiffany, though the plan did seem a little sophisticated for her. But people change. No one stays the same, not even him. He'd loved Tiffany once, with all the longing of love-struck youth. In high school, everything he did was in hopes of impressing her, to get her to notice him, to prove himself worthy. The prettiest girl in school, the sweetest and most popular. She was totally out of his league. From money, not that it ever made any difference to her, she kept telling him. But it did to Jason, who'd always felt in the shadow of her parents' affluence. He couldn't tell when things had changed between them, except that it started after her sickness began to define who she was, after medications changed her personality and made her space out half the time. Well, none of that mattered now. Melissa was alive. For the first time that day, he felt relief and a sense the world would be right again. He smiled at a group of Victorian bell ringers as they rang out holiday tunes near the wicker reindeer. Jason? He turned at the sound of Melissa's sweet voice. They embraced and kissed. He more passionately than her. Jason? She eyed him curiously after they parted. What are you doing? You're the one who always wanted to be careful in public. Oh, I don't care, he laughed. I'm thrilled to see you alive. And anyway, nobody's looking at us. He was right. Bag-burdened shoppers were either watching the bell ringers or were focused on finding their next purchase. Melissa shot him a sidelong glance. What's with you today? You're acting so strange. I thought you were dead. Her eyes narrowed. Don't say that. It's not funny. Jason pulled her away from the reindeer display, away from the crowd. He explained his breakfast conversation with Tiffany and all that had followed. She gave him a hard look. You saw the dent in the minivan? It's real? Oh, very real. Where is Tiffany? Melissa glanced around anxiously. She's not with you. No. After breakfast, she packed her bag and drove off to Thief River Falls to visit her sister. She's back tomorrow night, weather permitting. She just wanted to give me something to think about while she's gone. And she didn't sound angry? The opposite. She was so blasé about everything, it was weird, like she was in La La Land. Melissa inhaled sharply. It all makes sense now. Oh, my goodness. Her eyes filled with a terrible understanding. Tiffany's off in her own little world, he tried to explain. It's the meds. She's up to something. I just don't know what it is. Melissa grabbed his arm. Jason, how'd she find out about me? She didn't say, and I didn't ask. It was bad enough. I thought you were dead. She must be nuts to make up a story like that, Mel. It's not a story, Jason. Linda's dead. My next-door neighbor. You met her once 2 days ago. She was run over by a hit-and-run driver in front of my house. Your house? Melissa shuddered as she recalled something else. Linda even looks a bit like me. She was at my place to give my cat his insulin shot because I was here. Tiffany must have been waiting outside. Don't you get it? Tiffany thought Linda was me. Oh, it really wasn't a made-up story. Tiffany really did it. Ran over someone. We have to call the police. Turn her in. He felt the heat of Melissa's indignation, even admired it. That fire in her soul was made her exciting. Yes, he agreed, racing through the possibilities. Tiffany is arrested, goes to trial, with his testimony and the evidence of the minivan, she's convicted of murder, then jail. Incredible, he thought. She'd be out of the way by her own actions. It was perfect. Except for one thing. Jason, what is it? Maybe we ought to think this through before we get the police involved. Think it through. The woman killed my neighbor, almost killed me. We're not letting her get away with this. Keep it down. His eyes flickered toward passing shoppers, none of whom showed interest in them. Tiffany might not do any jail time. Given her recent behavior and the pills, a good lawyer could convince a jury she wasn't in her right mind. She could get off. Melissa shook her head in disbelief. Jason took her hand, savoring its softness. What about our plans? For months we've talked about running off to Seattle next summer. I've been squirreling away cash. We'll need it all to start a new life together. The catch is I work for Tiffany's father. If she's arrested for killing Linda, she'll say it was you she was really trying to run down. Then she'll explain why she wanted you dead. Roger will fire my sorry butt immediately. Believe me, that'll cut off the cash flow sooner than expected. So we're letting her off the hook? Oh, no, of course not. But there may be other options. Like what? He hesitated, aware he was heading into dangerous waters. Melissa's gaze locked into him. What other options? His tongue swiped across dry lips. Jason was at the edge of the precipice. It was now or never. We kill her, he said. Melissa stared back in disbelief. We can't do that. It's wrong. I know, darling, but wasn't it wrong of her to mercilessly run down your neighbor that was supposed to be you? She wrapped her arms around herself. I could never kill another person. He took her by the shoulders. And you won't have to. I'll handle everything. She shook her head. No, it's still wrong. This time with less conviction. We had a plan, darling. Tiffany nearly ruined it. She could still ruin it unless we stop her. I don't know. We can make it work, he came back. Just hear me out. When Tiffany gets back tomorrow, I'll be the contrite husband. Tell her I've been a fool. I'll say I've broken it off with you and come to realize how important she is to me. Oh, she'll lap it up. Circling his arm around Melissa's waist, he guided her away from prying ears. He spoke cautiously. We've got tickets to the Guthrie's A Christmas Carol. Tiffany loves that show. Afterwards, we'll drive around the neighborhoods and look at the holiday lights. Jason's eyes did a quick scan to make sure no one was listening in. We'll detour to a parking lot in a rough neighborhood. It's a big park-and-ride lot. That's where I'll do it. I'll get her out of the car on some pretense and knock her head against the fender. I'll say we were jumped by a gang of punks. I fought back, but there were too many of them. No, that won't work. It sounds phony. That's where you come in. Me? Oh, no, I told you. No, don't worry. You won't have to go near Tiffany. Like I said, I'll handle that. What you do is show up afterwards. I need to look like I got beat up, too. You gotta smack me a few times with a baseball bat. Use the bottom of your shoe on my face so I have abrasions and bruises. Things I couldn't have done to myself. Hit you. I couldn't. Yes. You can, darling. Maybe when you see Tiffany on the ground, you'll think of poor Linda in the street. I suppose, Melissa murmured, not quite convinced. Don't go over with the baseball bat, he added with a nervous laugh. Just a few smacks, enough to convince the cops it was a real attack. You don't have to break any bones. She thought it over. Will it work? Sure it will. I'll call 911 and do my act for the cops. You'll be long gone before they show up. Melissa glanced over her shoulder. I gotta get back. He moved in to close the deal. Darling, we can do this. It's the best way. If Tiffany dies from a random act of street violence, we're home free. I get everything. The house, the bank account, the Seattle move will be a breeze. You gotta tell me you're in. For a moment, she teetered on the edge of indecision. Okay, I'm in. Her voice was tight. But how will I find your car? Where's this parking lot? From his pocket, he pulled out a scrap of paper on which he scrawled directions. You know my car. Here's the license plate number and the location of the lot. Figure about 11:30 on Thursday evening. Okay, she fidgeted. My aunt's waiting. Just tell me you'll be there. A deep breath. I'll be there. I may hate myself later, but I'll be there. You've got to be. It all hinges on you. I'll get the bat to you this evening. If we do this thing right, we'll be home free. What a fun show, Jason. Thank you. Tiffany smiled broadly as they exited the theater. Around them, people buttoned up coats against the cold bite of evening. Such a great story and so uplifting. It is, he agreed, and meant it. The Guthrie's adaptation of A Christmas Carol was an old favorite. In the early days of their courtship, he and Tiffany came to the show every year. In fact, decades ago, it was a pair of free tickets that had motivated a socially awkward Jason Craig to dredge up the courage to ask out the prettiest girl at Central High. In the near distance, the downtown skyline shined in the dark like a giant holiday display. A light snow dusted them. Tiffany, mindful of the slush, stepped off the curb with a grunt. Oh, is your hip bothering you again? Yeah, a little. It's not too bad. She smiled, clutching a tiny polar bear plush toy close. He'd surprised her with the gift, which she held on to as if it were the most precious thing in the world. It didn't take much to make her happy, he thought. They were among a river of theater patrons making for the parking ramp across the street. A cold gust whipped the snow around them. Tiffany snuggled into her coat collar. The play was just terrific. Her sweet face looked at him meaningfully. And you've been so fun to be around, Jason. It's like when we first dated. These last few days have been, wonderful. Well, you deserve it. I behaved like an ass. Took you for granted. That won't ever happen again. I promise. She sighed. It's been so long since I've heard you talk to me that way. I've missed it. The serenity of her smile and the affection behind it touched him. He'd forgotten how radiant Tiffany could be when she was happy, maybe because he hadn't given her much cause to be happy in the recent few years. I spoke to Daddy yesterday. Jason slowed, tensing up. Oh, about what? About you, she said coyly. If she'd told the old man about Melissa, he was sunk. About me, he probed further, trying to mask his concern. Oh, something good, I hope. Oh, it was. I told Daddy how wonderful you've been. Anything else, sweetheart? I don't think so. You didn't mention the little discussion we've already had recently. Oh, gracious, no, she pooh-poohed. That's between you and me. I'd never tell him that. You know how he gets. Oh, Her face brightened. He said something about a promotion for you soon. Isn't that wonderful?
Wonderful and unexpected.
Jason smiled, charmed by Tiffany's buoyant outlook and the ease with which she handled her father, a man who didn't easily let go of grudges.
She didn't have to do that. She could have made Jason's life miserable.
Her thoughtfulness gave him pause to reflect.
The sweet face gazing back at him transported Jason to another lifetime when he was a gawky teen and she was the 18-year-old beauty who'd stolen his heart.
A swirl of emotions told him he still cared about her. And if that were true, how could he carry out his plan? Could he really kill the woman who'd meant the world to him at one time? The answer, he realized with a heavy heart, was no. He couldn't do it.
The realization hit him like a January wind chill. Jason knew everything had changed now. He had to let Melissa know. She'd be waiting.
Jason, Tiffany looked back with concern, is something wrong?
The parking ramp, he said, covering the slip. It's packed. Everyone's going to try to get out at once. Just beyond the ramp, a block away, a bright neon marquee caught his eye.
Maxine's. Hey, we haven't been there in ages. How about a drink? We'd just be stuck behind a line of cars for 30 minutes.
Ooh, maybe something hot.
Tiffany buried herself deeper into her coat collar. The snow was coming down harder. They stepped onto Washington Avenue and hurried to avoid oncoming traffic. As they reached the opposite curb, Tiffany's heel slipped on the slush.
Oh, careful, Jason steadied her. It's getting icy.
Tiffany's silver-blue eyes glistened in the lamplight.
Remember the time we went ice skating with Gary and he kept falling down?
Your cousin Gary?
Yeah, on Lake Minnetonka.
That was back in high school. Gary'd never been on skates before.
He talked like he knew what he was doing, but he kept falling on his butt.
He got madder and madder.
Man, he was furious.
Jason laughed. Maxine's was coming up fast. He glanced at the old brick facade, flanked on either side by juniper bushes wrapped in spirals of cranberry-colored mini lights. Jason and Tiffany converged with another group headed toward the restaurant.
With relish, Jason remembered how the story ended.
Yeah, Gary got so pissed he finally yelled at his feet.
I've had enough of you dumb old skates.
An older woman with a pinched face and blaze orange hair scowled at Jason as he brushed by her on the sidewalk leading to Maxine's. Jason and Tiffany climbed the 8 concrete steps up to the vintage double doors when he felt a sudden movement. Tiffany's foot had slipped on a patch of ice. A horrified gasp escaped her as she fell back, arms flailing helplessly toward him. Instinctively, he reached out. His fingers brushed her arm, catching on something for an instant before her weight and inertia ripped her from his grasp. Stunned, he watched her tumble backward and down. She landed hard on the cement steps, cracking her head.
Jason watched in stunned silence.
Gasps and cries nudged him into awareness. A young woman in a light parka and Peruvian stocking hat rushed to Tiffany's side. Only then did he realize something was in his hand. His gaze dropped to his still clenched fingers to see the head of a little plush polar bear.
Call 911, somebody cried.
It's too late, the young woman displayed her bloodied palm. I'm an RN. She's dead.
Dead? He blinked, just now comprehending. Tiffany was dead from her own clumsiness?
An accident in front of witnesses. It couldn't have worked out better if he planned it, and yet, in spite of this amazing piece of luck, he felt no pleasure at her death, only sadness, even shame.
Sir, the young woman asked, are you all right?
What a horrible accident, was all he could manage. The surprising thing to him was that he meant it.
Wait,
a voice protested from below.
The orange-haired woman hurried up the steps, her bony fingers gripping the wrought iron handrail for support. "Call the police. This was no accident. He pushed her. I saw it."
Jason's mouth fell open. "He pushed her," the woman insisted to the others who had gathered around the stairs.
I didn't push her. She slipped."
"You pushed her. You were arguing with her a second ago."
"Arguing? We weren't arguing."
"Don't lie to me. I heard."
"You called her a dummy,"
the old woman added with distaste. Two middle-aged women on the step near Jason gave him the evil eye.
"That wasn't what it was," Jason explained. "It was a funny story."
"You call this funny, young man?" The woman with the fiery hair pointed to Tiffany. "I know what I heard and what I saw. You pushed her."
"You saw it, didn't you?" she challenged a young mother two steps down.
The seed was planted.
"Well, yes, I did. His arm flew out. He must have pushed her."
"I saw it too," volunteered a bearded man on the sidewalk.
Jason clapped his hands on top of his head. "I didn't push her."
The old woman was resolute.
"You killed her. We all saw it, and that's what we'll tell the police. You won't get away with this."
Every face around him looked back with suspicion. Jason's shoulders sagged under the weight of their accusation. A cold reality told him his fate was already sealed. In silent acquiescence, his fingers relaxed and let the head of the plush toy fall where it bounced silently down the steps and into oblivion. I guess the lesson is just be careful what you wish for. Hey folks, that's going to do it. Thank you so much for tuning into the Mystery Hour here on Sunsounds. Keith Tyler here asking you to tune in once again, if you would please. Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.